One more time. The refuge prayers with bodhicitta. Remembering the meaning, practicing the deeper meaning as we recite. Sangye che don so ge jo nam la jan jo ba du da ne kyab su ji da ge jin so ji pe se nam ji jo la pen che sangye jo pa so Sangye che dan so ge jo nam la jan jo ba do da ne kyab su ji da ge jen so ji pe se nam ji Do la bhenje a sangye drumpa jo sangye che don so ge jo nam la jan jo bando da ne kyab su jin da ge jin so ji pe se nam ji jo la pen ji a sang ye drom pa so sem chan tam je de wa dan de we ju dan dam ba ju ji Dun 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 jin ju dun dun wa ju ji dun me ba de wa dam ba dam min ju wa ju ji ne den sa dun ne dun ju we dun nam chen ba la ne ba ju ji Sem chen tam je de wa dan de ve ju dan dem pa ju ji dun na dun dun na ji ju dan de wa ju ji dun na me pa de wa dam pa dam min de wa ju ji Ne den cha dan ne dan ja we tan nam chem pa la ne pa ju ji Sem chen tam je de wa dan de ve ju dan dem pa ju ji Dun na dan dun na ji ju dan de wa ju ji Dun na me pa de wa dam pa dam min de wa ju ji ne den cha dan ne dan ja we tan nam chem pa la ne pa ju ji and then sa we la ma dem pa ji Da ge chi wo pe de den chu la ka de che bu go ne je sun je ko sun tu ge ne du sa du sa So again, we first meditate a little bit. Meditating, remember, means not to dim down our awareness, but to open up into bright awareness. If awareness can rest straight ahead in its own nature, awareness resting in itself, that's fine. If it cannot rest just like that, then we have different possibilities. An important one is to look directly into the thirst for thinking, the wish to think. The wish to confirm our existence. Relaxing that wish is another possibility. If we look straight into it, there is a gap. If you relax it, it's also very fine. By relaxing the thirst for thinking, we relax our self-importance. I'm contemplating what that is that might be most important to say now as we are approaching the end of this retreat. What is it that you might need as an encouragement, a clarification? Let me go through what we have already seen. Let me make a little summary. We started out with some very relaxed practice of the basics of Anapanasati. Remember? Breathing in, breathing out, feeling the whole body. So this is always something you can come back to. And then, using this, it can become wider and wider. Like when we come to this breathing body, with this pranakaya, we can go into all the subtleties, all the different antenna of our being. It can become a very wide meditation, a way of being, very wide. And it will include all the other senses. And when going to the mental formations, I emphasized very much the self-liberating quality of whatever movements come up. So that would be the second group of four, yeah, working with mental manifestations. We have talked about the joy of being aware, the happiness in the body, talked about these factors to take them as an encouragement, as a to make practice easier. And just now what we did when I asked you to look at the thirst for thinking, actually this is for moments when we feel, okay, thoughts are self-liberating, so I can think as much as I want, and I'm dreaming on, everything self-liberating, very much at ease. Yes. And actually we take this view and as an excuse to continue on with our habitual complexity. Yeah. So when we look directly at this thirst for thinking or at the thinker and the meditator, then there comes a stop, and the rest is anyhow also self-liberating. But we work on a deeper tendency. It's like as if we were not putting fuel into the fire anymore. Yeah, we are not nourishing the fire of complexity. There has to be enough. Yeah, this is actually an important ingredient of the Mahamudra praxis, of all Buddhist practice, is to be fed up. To be fed up, this renunciation. Huh? This is to be fed up with the normal way of doing things, always creating more complexity, always entertaining similar kind of thoughts. So that is always a driving force behind us repeating the same Shema again, the same pattern. And so I hope for everybody to be thoroughly fed up. Yeah, because it's creating so much dukkha, so much stress in the mind. Like we are not aware that this machine which is running constantly, this thinking machine, that we are constantly fueling it. We are always putting energy into it. So we have to find out the ways not to fuel more energy into this complexity, and that would create, which creates all these thoughts about hope, fear, you know, past, present, future, all of that. It's like, it's like withdrawal from a drug. Huh? Like when you practice withdrawal, like from a drug, it's not so easy. It's like you're really missing something, but you want to do it. And in the best of cases, you already know the benefits. Maybe you feel them already, but it's still difficult because something is missing. And so when we sit like this and we don't fuel our thoughts anymore, our complexities or preoccupations, then often we feel boredom. Boredom is like a withdrawal symptom. Yeah, boredom and solitude. And we feel a restlessness that wants to do something, that wants to engage. And again, if we feel it, again, directly, we relax. Yeah, just sit, just sit, just sit. But we sit in clarity, and this is a big difference. We don't shut down. We sit in clarity, feeling all what that means to sit in the not knowing. Just not knowing. Not knowing what all of this is about. It's just not as before. I'm not filling all the empty spaces with all the mental chatter. I stop the mental chatter, but there is nothing else filling it right now. Until we discover, until we become so fine that we discover, wow, there are underlying qualities that begin to show, and it takes a while. It takes a while of getting used. Getting used to this absence of mental busyness. You know, like in the outer world, we have some busyness to do. Like this, we are busy on the inside, the mental busyness. So in the absence of that, first our life seems to be empty, but in the, you know, in the usual negative sense, like, what's going on? And in that situation, then it is good to practice bodhicitta, tonglen, with yourself, you know? To breathe in and to breathe out, to give yourself a little support and to bring in a loving kindness, to offer yourself this love, this understanding, and this very gentle awareness. That will fill the painful gap, but not with chatter. Yeah, it will not fill it with complexity, but actually you're beginning a healing process through which you can relax, through which we can relax more deeply. Okay? You remember how to do that? We did it together. You remember those moments when we did it? You look as if you didn't remember. You don't? We need to do it again? Then let's do it. Ready? Breathing in and breathing out with deep kindness. Breathing from the heart, you can say. Or even letting a Buddha breathe from your heart. Breathing with loving awareness into every cell of the body. And full of love, letting go of the out-breath, letting go of all that complexity, all of that which burdens us. Now you remember how we did this loving body scan, going to every part of the body, saying hello, good morning, loving awareness going everywhere. And always a little bit more relaxed. No need to do so much, just offering exactly what is needed. So there is mental movement, there are mental formations, but there are wholesome ones. Every in-breath, every out-breath, filled with compassion, with love. Feeling how we are filled with this. And it might even overflow, might even radiate outside. We can imagine it as light flowing outside. Light flowing in, light flowing out. And then when you feel that, oh, this was good, my restlessness is less, then I can decide to just leave it as such and simply sit, be aware. And this awareness now is not so painful anymore, or it is not painful at all. It feels fine. Because the heart has been activated, this love and compassion have been activated. This is just a little reminder, because the idea is that I explain to you the common structure of the meditations. You see, we can create a space in which we do not entertain thoughts about the past, the future, and the present. It's possible to let go, but then most of us, we will feel a lack. We will feel like, well, okay, nice to have no thoughts, but what's that good for? Yeah. And so the Mahamudra approach is to actually work with the creative mind, with wholesome mental movements. And this was just one. This was just, you know, loving kindness with ourselves. But we had others. Remember, we had the blessing showering in from above with Vajrasattva. We had the blue Buddha in the heart radiating, or we had the Buddha in front with, and we always, this is, these are all kinds of very wholesome mental activities. Yeah, they come from these enlightened visions. We relive them in the visualizations. We relive them, and always to the point where we notice, ah, now it's like the inner needs are satisfied. There is a fulfillment. Yeah, there is like, it feels round. The neediness is gone. The wholesome states have become healing. Yeah, there's a healing effect. And then we just sit. We just continue. You know, every time we do a visualization, and all the time it dissolves, it becomes light, the light dissolves into us, and then we rest in simplicity. And then it is a different simplicity from before, when we are just trying to be simple. It's an activated simplicity, you can say. The heart is activated, our whole being. And with blessing, with devotion, with love, compassion, joy, you know, these qualities, and gratitude, and what it may be. So Basically, we don't leave a nothingness in the meditation, but we then turn to something that is really inspiring, that is opening us up. And when we feel open and round, we leave that wholesome mental activity and we go to utmost simplicity. Yeah, we go to not doing anything. And then this is where we enter actually something like a taste of non-meditation. No one is doing anything anymore. We are not specifically engaged in cultivating shamatha. We also not inside. The beginning, it's just awareness resting in itself. And then, as again, the habitual movements start, the mind movements, then of course we have different possibilities. And I gave you some, I gave you these, again, these five, yeah, the five aspects of timeless awareness, to contemplate a little bit on mind's nature, to remind it, and that sometimes is enough to open up again into a simple being. You know, these five spacious, fluid, ungraspable, vivid, and perfect, complete. Reminders which kind of help ourselves to settle back through the short moments of, you know, these reminders, these sati moments of remembering the qualities of mind, is of course a contemplative process, but then it's followed by and we sit in the yeah, this is where we sit. We don't sit in the words that we were using. We sit in the effect that they have produced. So we can do like this. Or we can use these four steps of insight meditation that we went through. You know? All phenomena are mind. Mind is empty, emptiness is spontaneous presence. Spontaneous presence is self-liberating. And just the taste of that, you know, also, it's just a helper to see and then to be able to sit in the seeing. But we don't maintain those instructions. They are only a short reminder, a little bridge to walk over. And sometimes, it's like a question. Is it true that mind cannot be found, for example? And you know, like this question, and looking inwards and sitting in that space. And like this, you will find that these reminders of insight, reminders of what's the nature of mind, they will help to go into deeper and deeper shamatha. There is an effect of the insight practice on a more and more natural shamatha, which already comes from a deeper seeing and a deeper trust. And basically, that's what we are going for. We are going for this deepening of trust. Trust in our own mind. Trust in that what we started the retreat with, you know, this Buddha nature, this ground Mahamudra, you know, trusting that. And then we discover it. And we begin to see that it is always helpful in our practice when these wholesome states that we are creating, remember that going for refuge, for example. Yes, I can go alone for refuge, but it's so much more helpful to have all sentient beings around. And to have many Buddhas, you know, to feel the connectedness. When we receive the blessing of Vajrasattva, yes, it is fine to feel it, but it's good that it spills over and goes outside, and that simultaneously all others are going through the same process. When we breathe in and breathe out the light, you know, the loving awareness and so on in the anapana practice, that it goes through the, that it goes outside through the body, that we are connected, that the out-breath is at the same time an offering, you know, an offering of light into the world, and that actually light comes back, so there's communication. So all these Mahamudra techniques, these methods that we have gotten to know so far, they all have a communicative aspect. And this is very important to gradually dissolve our self-centeredness in this interbeing, this connectedness, this togetherness, this open, yeah, not creating boundaries, but actually opening the usual boundaries, yeah, opening them in many ways. So these are the basic, you can say, the basic ideas, the experiences behind these techniques, that we use these qualities that have been named in order to find ways, and always a warm, open, connected awareness where there are no more separations, and also where a center cannot be found. Like there's no center in the joy, in the love, in the compassion, in the devotion, in the general, in the gratitude. And yeah, it's like always opening like this. And with the time with time, I mean, with the months and years of practice, we begin to see that this is the most natural of the world. What we called a method before, a technique, is actually simply imitating what is happening automatically in a free mind. The best methods are those who imitate free mind, okay, which are very close to what is the perception of a Buddha, for example. How would a Buddha perceive the world? You know, seeing the world with the eyes of the awakened ones. So whatever takes us in that direction, of course it's artificial, but it opens us in a direction that when the method drops away, actually mind likes it so much because it is close to one's own nature, and then it continues in natural ways, which resemble the techniques, but which are of course not identical. We don't need to visualize white or blue Buddhas. Yeah, it's no need. Yes. But to see Buddhas everywhere, this is natural. Yes. And it's very natural to experience life as blessing. Very natural. It's very natural to live life as a complete practice of dana, of giving. We don't have to tell ourselves that. That's naturally the case for some free beings. So all of these, this is what I wanted to say a little bit, all these methods, and you will listen through the audios, you will see your notes and so on. This is the common denominator of these methods. They approach us, they help us approach the experience of freedom. And of course, they are artificial for as long as they are methods, but they open up into something which is just around the corner. When the method drops away and the naturalness of that arises, then it is like this. So what I meant to encourage you is Yes, I encourage you to use the various methods that we have shared, to use them in your practice as wholesome mental movements to enter wholesome mental states. And then you can look at the nature of the mind itself. When you drop the method, the nature will become even more obvious, even more clear. So those of you who have time at home or in retreat, then practice this alternation between energy, more energy into the practice, and relaxing, you know, straightening, tensing, relaxing, until you find what is helpful, where you need to bring in the energy and where you don't need to bring in the energy, where you relax and where you don't need to relax, you know, like finding out, always going forth and back. It's like a swing. You know, in the beginning, the meditator, when there is like torpor, then there comes the correction for the torpor, more effort, and the swing goes into too much effort and restlessness. And then there comes the correction for too much restlessness. Oh, I need to relax. I shouldn't make effort anymore. There's a good moment, and then back into torpor again. So good meditator, experienced meditator, makes little corrections. The swing doesn't have to go to the extremes. It's like swinging in clarity, swinging in openness, and already the first sign of torpor, and you know how to straighten up a little bit. The first signs of restlessness, you know how to relax a little bit. You know, it's like becomes very subtle. And this is the art of meditation, to only do this tiny adjustments so that it really becomes like the flight of an eagle. It's a very powerful mind, but this powerful mind is soft. Soft and really feeling just what's needed to go with the flow, with the karmic flow of the moment, which is like the winds for the eagle. The winds in the air is like our karmic winds. Some day it's stormy, other day it's like no wind at all, and so on. Yeah, so we adapt. And this is the skill to develop for this. Longer periods of meditation are a little bit more helpful, because in short meditation periods, when we just have 20 minutes or half an hour, then probably it's good to have a little routine, you know, to start with the refuge, then have our main practice pretty much clear, have a dedication, and then maybe some time to prepare the day, to prepare our activities. Yeah, then that would be the standard. And then, of course, within the standard, there one adapts to the present moment, but one doesn't have so much time to feel the effect of the slight changes. Do you have any questions on that? Is there something that, yes, Svenam Lindrup. Yes? The lengths of meditation. Do you have any recommendation? Well, let's be honest. I was for many years, for decades, I was guiding these long retreats. And then after the long retreats, after several years of retreat, then the question would be, so How much practice is needed? The answer of daily practice needed is between 3 or 4 hours in order not to lose one's practice. Yes? And continue deepening it. This is the experience of all those retreat guides that we have looked at, hundreds of people who have done long retreats. To say that, except if you are a really, really experienced meditator, then of course you can have a week or two where you don't meditate, no problem. You pick it up later again. Yeah, but you will pay the price. Someone, for example, who has practiced for 3 years in retreat, goes out, has a family, has to do his job, and is not practicing. Within a year, the benefits of that retreat might be lost already. There's still a memory, and there's still the capacity to pick it up. But to keep it going, the minimum would be an hour a day but if you really want to be in it and to feel that your life is breathing the Dharma, and you're not just maintaining, but you're breathing the Dharma, and the Dharma becomes the life becomes your Dharma and your practice, you need more. And so, sorry for the honest answer, but it's not an answer that is adapted to your life situation before it is given. Now the adaptation comes afterwards, okay? It's just, you know, it's easy for me. I'm a very busy man, okay? But I have my 5 to 8 in the morning is my sacred time. No one disturbs me. 5 to 8, no disturbance, okay? And then I eat my breakfast. And then, okay, the life rules me. But 5 to 8, I am the boss of my life, so to speak, mostly, yes? Except when I have to go running with you, right? But then you are my boss, and I know the rest of the day I will meditate. But now she was very kind. She saved my life because she took care that I'm always fit, yeah, for these long days. No, but my sportive activity usually comes afterwards. It's not in the 5 to 8. It's like sacred time. Everyone knows it. I live in a house with many people. Roughly 25 to 30 people would normally be there. And of course, they have all kinds of questions. And about this, everyone knows. No way. Even up to 9 or 10 o'clock, I start working in my room. I don't usually go out, but hey, this you can do, most of you, except if you have children, then it's a different story. But most of you, if you go to bed early enough, you can get up early enough. Can be done. Then you have your time. Yeah, so that's, and then in the evening you do some more practice, or during the day, yeah, then you can see what is possible. So much for this question. Yes. The question is if I can talk about the Mahamudra book, how it's structured, how we can use it. Actually, I have not been referring to this book at all. It has only been lying here for my inspiration, and I read a few lines here and there. And I originally thought I would give you more of the contents of this book, but over the last retreat and this retreat, I found that it's not completely fitting to the situation. So the book which I would advise you, which is fitting to the situation, is actually called Heart Advice of a Mahamudra Master by Gendron Rinpoche. It's in English. You can find it on the internet. I composed it of the different public instructions of Gendron Rinpoche. It gives you the whole Dharma with a good Mahamudra section on shamatha, insight meditation, mahamudra is in there, but also about bodhicitta, about the four basic thoughts, the relationship with the teacher, preparing for dying, working with emotions, you know, all of that is in there. So heart advice, heart, like my heart, heart, here, my heart, advice of a mahamudra master and by Gendun Rinpoche. And some of you have it already. Does anyone have it here? You have it here? On the Kindle, have you have it as a book? Can you get it from your room? Yeah? So in the next pause, you when we make a pause, you go and you bring it, and then it, people can look at it. That's really nice. So this book, if you want to study it, you should study it together with the teachings I gave on this book, which were translated into English as well. And then you can go through step by step, and you will have benefit from that. Yes. It's not on YouTube. You have to go to the media library of the Ekayana Institute. The Ekayana, you have found already? Now, this is where all my teachings can be found. Yeah, this Ekayana Institute for Contemporary Buddhism is the name of the foundation, the non-profit organization that I'm guiding, and we have built this up in the last years. This is also where your donations will go to at the end of this course. They don't go to me personally, they go to this work of serving everybody for free. Can download all the things which are offered there. So you will find audios, and whatever you cannot find, you send an email, we will help you to find it, or we will post it for you. But there should be the recordings of the instructions on the moonbeams of Mahamudra, and also the instructions from Greece on the Ocean of True Meaning by the Ninth Karmapa. Ocean of True Meaning by the Ninth Karmapa, with all the instructions directly in English. So these are 7 years of instructions on that book, which is the key book on Mahamudra practice in the 3-year retreats. That's what we were practicing, you know. So go slowly, go step by step, and always listen to the explanations. Yes, and then, of course, we need to have this personal contact from time to time so that you get a personal taste, because it's not just by audios that one learns this. Yeah. Okay, you too. Well, this is for after the break. We make a break now, and Duri is your name. We will take up Duri's question again, because it is taking us again into looking at reality and what I explained this morning. Yeah, and looking a little bit at Nagarjuna, and we will keep your question in mind. Yes? Okay. But before entering this, since I risk to be a little bit long on the subject, then we better make a break before. Okay? Okay, so we have We come back at 5 o'clock, reading a book that gives you a feeling of like what my teacher was actually saying himself, and who have misunderstood that the way I explained self-liberation and the empty nature and so on, that phenomena were not real, and especially that, for example, something as, you know, the war would not be real or something, you know? And so it was very important for me to make it clear, not being solid doesn't mean that something is not real. Like, not solid is what means not to be empty, right? So the word real here means it is a real experience. And it is an experience of life and death, right? It's very real experience, but doesn't mean that any part of that has substance. Okay, that was the one with the real. And then you made a link to Nagarjuna with cause and effect. You want to say more, or shall I just continue? Wirklich, wirklich, something which has an effect. Now, you were very, very, you're here with the ears of Nagarjuna, and you hear Nagarjuna's teaching that cause and effect are not separate. Yes? So cause and effect are simultaneous. And so we cannot talk about an effect separate from the cause, which is very true. It's an ongoing simultaneity of cause and effect. So I wasn't talking at that level of precision. Yes, so so when we say something has an effect, this is conventional language. Yeah, just the way we talk, that we live this resonance, so reality kind of stimulates and resonates in us, although the resonance and the so-called reality are also simultaneously. There's no cause and effect separate. It's not that first something happens and then there is the resonance. It's like always the simultaneity. Well, you already corrected yourself that you would not use the word things. Yeah, phenomena appear, but do not exist. And often we add the word as such. The as such means independent from other conditions, causes, and so on. So phenomena appeared and do not exist as such. And their appearance can be very heavy, can be very happy, can be, yes, can have all kinds of forms. So, your question now. Two questions. You are going for it. Okay. Your kids were asked, who's shouting more at home, mom or dad? You were the dead, right? You were the dead. So you're talking about the help of a cigarette or eating something in order to keep your temper and not to hurt someone else with strong speech. So, yes, to smoke and to eat or overeat and not, or to drink and so on, these are not the top solutions. Yeah, it's like, it's okay if your motivation is better not to shower, better to take a cigarette than to yell at your wife. I can, it's a very good motivation. But I would look for the cheaper one. Cigarettes cost money, right? And no, cheaper is like, I would look for one which ruins your health less, of course. Yes? No, that is an urgent need to learn to do what to do with your mind without the help of substances. Yes. So this learning we cannot do now in the discussion. This was already the last days, and you said the last days it was quite easy for you, right? A little bit easier. Well, I have a very easy thing. With when it concerns your wife and you're about to shout, just tell her, take me in your arms. Don't try with the friends. The friends, they have to drink alcohol before they do it. But your wife, if you have an agreement that you can settle a dispute by sparing all the words, by simply going directly to the solution, which is taking each other in the arms, you save the cigarettes, you save the words, you save the time. No, you go straight for the solution. I know, I remember. And you survived, you came back. So, and you didn't come to kill me, so we can go the next step. Go to the toilet. Don't go smoke a cigarette, just go to the toilet. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes, a lot, but it's not taught outside these intensive retreats. We have very intensive yogas and pranayama practices, and of course, I mean, for you it would be very good to do the 111,000 prostrations. Yeah, that would be very good because that cleanses the body, and you don't imagine how much the nicotine is coming out, you know, from all the cells, you know, just by. By doing this is a deep cleansing. So we start with that. No, this is all only given by the teacher directly. All these physical yogas are not offered to people outside. I mean, no, I only give it to individual people in long-term retreat after 3, 4 years of retreat. Ask your wife. Okay. Jasmine first. Self-importance and pride. Oh, then we are back to the prostrations. You know, I know that in a certain culture, Then one doesn't bow down, not in front of a Buddha and so on, but the practice of bowing down is incredibly good. This practice of giving oneself for the benefit of beings and bowing down in front of the awakened ones is actually an incredible practice. If you ask for a specific one, that's the first one. But actually, all Dharma practices reduce pride and self-importance. I wouldn't know an exception. Refuge reduces it. Contemplating impermanence reduces it. Contemplating karma reduces it. Contemplating samsara reduces it. So refuge, bodhicitta, the visualizations with Vajrasattva. You take any practice, I think you will find out it reduces self-importance and pride if it is applied properly. Oh, self-care and self-pride are self is really the opposite. Because actually pride comes from a lack of self-confidence. We should know that. Huh? Pride comes from fear. So pride is actually a protection. And to take good care of oneself, this feeling individual which needs support, and actually pride is also a way of asking for love, but it's a very devious way. Yeah, so if you take good care of yourself in this real sense, not in the way a proud person takes care of itself, then if you take good care in this deeper sense, this insecure child, which then develops the pride as a compensation, if you take good care of that, it's an antidote for pride. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. If you want me to elaborate about how these 4 hours would look like, then actually they evolve, they change with the years of practice. You know, they are never the same. So I cannot give you the one structure. Someone like you mean? First of all, in your practice, however long it is, then the practice of insight and compassion, they should be balanced. Yeah. So a practice only on wisdom, insight, will become dry with the time. You will sit in a dry form of believing that you understand the mind or that you have insights. But so you always need to have the practices like Tonglen, this breathing. I didn't go far this time, but we were only doing it with ourselves. Last time we did a little bit breathing with others, but this is a whole practice to learn. Yes. To begin breathing with compassion, love, and then at the inside the heart, the wisdom that knows the nature of phenomena. So that would be a very important practice or forms of metta meditation. Any form of bodhicitta practice that should balance the shamatha vipassana practice, which is very important. The root of practice is silent practice, calming the mind, settling, then looking into what's going on to develop insight. And that's the basic practice. I already talked about this heart opening practice, and then there is always a practice to work with your strongest emotions. So we mentioned these 5 steps, and this is something, of course, that one would learn. How do I actually deal with situations in which I became angry yesterday, or if I still feel anger today? How, how to work with that step by step. When I'm full of hatred, when I feel fear, I close my mind. When I feel, like I want to push someone out of my life, when I feel, all these emotions, they need a place in our daily practice. A practice of 3-4 hours a day, if you have that time, easily offers an hour where we deal with the daily emotions and challenges and so on, and we work with that. And then, of course, in those 3-4 hours is not yet included that a healthy practice includes something to do for the body. So this is in the other part of the day that you go jogging, cycling, do asanas, practice tai chi, go to the fitness center, whatever is your choice. So this is also for a healthy balance very important. So you get a little bit an idea. And if you still have more time, then you can do a second session of practice, which is then again a little bit different. But we were doing 4 sessions of 3 hours per day of retreat plus 1 hour group practice. And in the lunch break, on top of that, we would study. Okay, that's a retreat. That's like a full-blown 3-year retreat. That is the daily structure. And that's also in our house. We keep that, but we add, in that time, one can go out in nature and practice in nature. And in that time, you can do some study also. It's good if you always include a little bit of reading or listening in your practice, because it keeps the inspiration alive and it deepens the understanding. Did you say you had 2 questions? Movement. There are times in our practice when we are developing mental calm deeply and we go into samadhis. In those times when that is happening, then we don't activate the body with wild movement. Yes? So we go for very relaxed movements. And if you ask for the Mahamudra perspective, we take out all ambition from whatever we are doing. We are not running with a clock trying to see if we were a little bit quicker today. We are not trying to always increase the weights in the fitness center. We are not, all this effort, this ambition and all of that. The always, whatever you do, if you do swimming, whatever you do, you always listen to your organism, to your body. You always develop resonance. You always look not to manipulate. Yeah, this the attitude remains the same. You develop a spacious attitude, like you're running with your dog, okay? I hope you don't have to hold it on the leash, that it can run by itself, so that you have the time to feel that you are running in space and maybe in metta, in really an open heart, and maybe even reciting mantras silently, without pronouncing them, but inwardly to offer to the places you want to. So you can practice while you're running all these repetitive sports where we do the same thing for a longer time. They're very good in order to practice. And I'm a fan of doing that half an hour per day, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. It gives me the necessary energy to remain healthy enough for all these challenges. Okay. Practicing during sleep, yes? Yeah, you see, in my tradition, this practice of the six yogas of Naropa, six dhammas of Naropa, is not taught publicly, because we wait for the first signs. We wait, and before we teach dream yoga, we wait for the practitioner to develop the first signs of lucid dreaming, and then we give the instructions. This is something which happens naturally when the mind is looking through the illusory nature of phenomena during the day, and then even in the dream, that this will begin at night when we begin to look through. And in the same way, we look for the first signs of an inner clarity in the deep sleep experience before we give the instructions on clear light and luminosity. So yes, there are books on the market. If you put into the search machine, if you put six yogas of Naropa, you will probably find books. And there is lots of books on lucid dreaming. But lucid dreaming is not the end of the road. We want to practice Mahamudra in the dream. We want to use it in order to go to different realms of experience. And so on. There's a lot to do there. So this is something which is between teacher and student. One looks when the moment is ready, when the practitioner is ready. Because if you start before, then you can learn these visualizations, you know, different preparations one can, but it's all done in an atmosphere of fascination and wanting. And the good results of these practices are to reduce wanting and clinging even more. So if the motivation is a fascination, it will not go in the right direction. One might have some little results, but it's not going to go very far and might even increase the pride of the practitioner. So we are careful with that. Yes. So I don't give you sources now because I'm not using these sources which are on the market. I have my own translations of the Tibetan texts explaining all of that. And when needed, then I give those transmissions. All the way back. Yes. The question is, I repeat for everybody, why did the Buddha not put the equanimity as the fourth one of the four immeasurables and not as the first point in the list? I think he wouldn't object. And there are actually traditions which teach it like this, that start with equanimity and develop the four immeasurables from there, because otherwise, love without equanimity is actually can easily be attachment or desire and so on. Yeah, so see them all together, and if you wish, start with equanimity. And maybe, like in all these Buddhist lists, you know, maybe good to make a circle out of them. Usually, when I teach, I put the four in the four different directions. This is easy because in the tantric tradition, when you have you visualize the palace of a deity, yeah, like I would be the medicine Buddha, for example. I sit as the medicine Buddha in a symbolic palace, which is my retreat hut, which is visualized as a palace, and then it has four doors. All the palaces of the peaceful deities, they have four doors, and these four doors are the four immeasurables. So, meaning that if you want to enter the palace of bodhicitta, of the Buddha, you have to go through one of these doors. And just depends from which direction you are coming, then you enter through equanimity, through love, through joy, through compassion, like this. So we put them, when we explain them in more detail, we put them like in the four directions, and like this, then they begin to communicate with each other. There are cross across influences, and actually it's all just one quality. Yes. Okay. Rama. If I can make the difference between love and compassion, or metta and karuna, yes, actually is the same quality when it is called love or metta, maitri, then it is the attitude of wishing for happiness. Wishing for freedom, so wishing for the qualities to develop. And when it is, when this warm heart wishes for the suffering to go away, the suffering to be dissolved, and the causes of suffering, then it is called compassion. But it is, of course, connected. If you have a child, you want it to be free from suffering and its quality developed, that it becomes happier. So they always go together. It's like with the in-breath and the out-breath. Symbolically, we can say the in-breath would be like, if we relate to another being, the in-breath would be taking all the suffering, you know, accepting all of what comes from that person, or, and letting it dissolve then in the wisdom and the equanimity. And to support the other person, the Buddha nature, would be the love, you know, would be. But it's actually the same heart breathing. It's you don't need to make to draw a strict line, because to make someone happy, we have to help reduce the suffering. And sometimes to reduce the suffering, you can start by increasing the qualities. So they always go together. Is it more clear, or did you know all of that already? You knew it already. So then make your question more fine. There are different aspects of the same movement. Like, we have so many names for different aspects of the same movement. You know, we talk about, for example, generosity as being a different quality than love and compassion. But actually, no need to talk about that. When you have love and compassion, generosity is automatically there. So if you begin to understand, then all of these descriptions of the qualities, they come to be one great quality. And that has received the name of bodhicitta, which is actually a mind free of clinging to this one here. Yeah, and this free mind is naturally in those qualities. They don't need to be listed separately. But we do list them separately, because in the beginning, devotion feels a little bit different from love, although in the end they are confluent. You feel that love and devotion become the same energy. But sometimes you can make a difference. You can see that. And like this, we differentiate, because it refers to slightly different tastes of experiences. But in the end, all of them are connected. Oh, the kitchen team has to go to the kitchen. And maybe we can make a little applause for the kitchen team. Yes. Go ahead. Also two. Oh, my dears, if you all take two questions, go ahead. So slowly, slowly. The question is what to do with those phenomena that happen during the meditation, after the meditation. You sometimes you don't have strength in the muscles, sometimes you feel a very strong energy in the chest and so on. And all of this happens while you're in meditation, and then you wonder what to do with it afterwards. Usually they disappear afterwards. They don't disappear. It's coming after the meditation. This looks strange. You say the samadhi is drawing you. It's like feeling pulled, feeling like the samadhi wants you to come back into it. This is not so easy for me to answer. With the samadhi like inviting you back, you feel like being pulled back. This is a normal phenomenon of clinging to samadhi, to mental calm, and the mind feels like, oh, I want to stay. It's like we can say like this. So, but most of these phenomena, they sound like something happening in your prana system very strongly. And this I cannot answer in a question like this, because we would have to find out, or you actually have to find out, what are the specific blockages that create, for example, a loss of energy in the arms after the meditation. You know, so all of that needs a much closer look. Yeah, it is not something very common. And but it can be found out. It is some kind of blockage in the energy system. The normal thing is that after a relaxed meditation, an open meditation, what we call samadhi, that the energies flow freely. And even if there is some clinging to the samadhi after a few seconds, half a minute and so on, everything is very smooth. And in a Mahamudra samadhi, which is so open and there's no clinging, then one can immediately go into action. There is no need for transition time. So all of the rest is all due to clinging. But what are these mechanisms that close off some energies and stimulate others so strongly? I cannot answer like this. I'm sorry. And the second question. About clinging. And that fits. We're clinging regarding the world. So what happens when you release the clinging to the world? Yeah, you see, this seems to be, we are coming to the problem. Actually, you think you release the clinging. Because actually you drive out the thoughts, you drive out the world, you create a bubble, and this creates also the energy problems. So when you release the clinging to the world doesn't disappear. You know, the world means all the phenomena of your senses. So if you enter the nothingness, when you think you release the clinging to the world, actually you're chasing the world away, you're blocking the world. And then happen symptoms of blockage. Now what happens when we release the clinging to the world? Actually we enter this deep equanimity where there's no attachment, no aversion. And when there is the best of possibilities to see how everything that appears is self-liberating. That means it's no problem. And this creates an even greater sense of interconnectedness and deep, deep peace, because there is no emotional reaction to the world. So look a little bit into misunderstandings of what it means to release. Yeah. Releasing the clinging is releasing the grasping to something that appears, but it doesn't mean it shouldn't appear. So releasing the clinging to sounds doesn't mean that sounds shouldn't appear. Releasing the clinging to visual sights doesn't mean there is no more seeing, but there is no more. What is not there anymore is this fixing, this focusing. Same, there's no need to interpret the sounds, but the hearing doesn't stop. So you need to go into this direction with your exploration. This will be very helpful. I'm very happy you asked the second question, because it seems to contain the answer to the first one. Mm-hmm. Okay. One about sleeping and the other about? What was the second? Yes, the second subject I didn't Okay. I don't know that practice. Are dependent on each other, but they don't truly exist. Yes. So because that is subject and object produced in our mind, then also the notion of time begins to appear. Okay. Tell me, before you continue, tell me why this question is important to you. Is it a practical question? Is this something I cannot feel the practice implications, because it sounds very theoretical. So, giving the time independent existence, that is a problem. You shouldn't do that. Yes. The time idea disappears with completely entering into being. Then the notion of time disappears. So I advise that. Yes, this is also when the memory, the classical form of memory, disappears. Yes, so there is no other practice in order to dissolve something like time, except there are analytical procedures which help us to understand how much linear time is simply an idea. But this you have already been through, so the practice to see, to experience the timelessness of experience is actually to enter the non-dual awareness. So, what do you want to see then directly? There is no seer. There is no seer in the, yeah? Okay. So that, but then you, okay. Then you see it, then you become a seer without seeing. Yeah, it's like this. Yeah, it's difficult with the words. Yeah, it's difficult. Now I get you. Okay. If I can say a few words about psychosis and schizophrenia, it's a little bit easier to talk about psychosis than about schizophrenia, although the two are connected. Maybe you can have some benefit if I talk a little bit about psychosis. The mechanism of psychosis is the same clinging that we have to our mental contents, only that the mental contents is extremely accelerating. Yeah, there's a very strong grasping, and our normal tendency to give meaning to everything what we see and hear and so on continues, but the effect of a highly activated mind is such that the interpretations of reality and the succeeding triggers for such interpretations, they gradually detach from the normal realm of communication, and they enter their own world of interpretation. Now, this is the basic mechanism. What you can perceive is that psychosis is not something continuous. There are moments of clarity. Yeah, there's in every psychosis, if one is aware, that are kind of the continuity of this mechanism sometimes is interrupted, and for a short time, the person is lucid, is fine, is in touch, and then the mechanism starts again. So the whole healing process of psychosis, because psychosis and the underlying schizophrenia, if there is, with the tendency to reproduce psychotic crisis, can be healed. You can recover from that by enhancing these islands of clarity. Yeah, these stretches of an aware and resonating mind, same as what we have talked about, they need to be identified, and the interest in these gaps of clarity within the overall picture of psychosis, this interest needs to be nourished so that the other people would say return to normality, but this is not return to, we are actually creating an interest for the mind's own luminosity, for the mind's clarity and the capacity of feeling and love and compassion in the moments which are different from the normal turbulence of psychosis. And when this is enhanced, when someone knows how to support that, then these, we call them islands of clarity, they become bigger and they last longer. And the psychotic times, the times passed in this turbulence of clinging and interpretations and so on, becomes less. And it needs the motivation of the person in the psychosis, the wish to come out of it. Without that wish, it is very difficult. Now, if you want to consult a book on that, for this I have a book, and it's by Edward Podvoll, Podvoll, Edward, was an American psychiatrist, psychanalyst, and a very dear friend of mine, who wrote the book, which is nowadays called Recovering Sanity. It's the whole book is about psychosis, a fantastic book. The original title was The Seduction of Madness. That was the original title. And we were very close friends. He was a student of Trungpa Rinpoche, and he was the founder and head of the Naropa Institute, which became the Naropa College and nowadays Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. So if you want to know more, this is a very enlightening book about psychosis. And then schizophrenia is an underlying, you can say, terrain, a ground from where psychosis may spring, and it has many different aspects to it. Yeah. What is a borderline personality, and so on, different aspects. And this I'm not so comfortable to talk about. It's not so clearly identifiable. Does it help you? Does you want to go here? Okay. You will look for the book. Okay. We change our tendency to the some parts to the real nature of mind. Say your question. The question is whether we don't just change our wired brain plasticity. If we, you know, these questions related to modern brain research, the Mahamudra masters, they would pretty much say, well, the brain shows what the mind actually is, because the mind, this experience, continues after leaving this body and not having a brain. And it was there already before. And since they have these, there are masters who remember their previous lifetimes, they can know where beings are, and they can communicate with them even have left this body. So for them, it's not that we are, of course, the brain wiring change and we use the plasticity of the brain as we are in this body. But this is a side effect of working with the mind, because the brain seems to follow what we do with the mind. So it's not, yeah? So the way we use our mind has an effect on the brain, but this effect of how we use our mind continues even when we have no more brain. And during dementia, we are still in this body. So in dementia, the brain functioning is limited, and that will have an effect on the person. Definitely. So in dementia, this brain limitation is limiting what the person experiences. This is definitely true. But when the person dies, the dementia is gone as well. Yeah, I verified also, because of course I asked these questions, and I wanted to know how is it with different form of dementia and mental illnesses and so on. What happens when a person dies? How should I talk with that person after death? What happens to a child? Is a child still a child when it dies, or has it suddenly a different access to more understanding and so on? So. Yes, and it seems that all these limitations due to physical handicap, which is dementia, is seen as a physical handicap. Yeah, it is in the brain, but it is a physical structure that is not functioning well. So all of that will be gone afterwards. So the awareness during dementia is incredible. It's fluctuating all the time. And just like in unconsciousness, when people are in coma, we should be very careful what we think about the awareness of the person in dementia. I just lost my mother-in-law 2 months ago from dementia. And similar to what I said about the psychosis, they were always, not quite in the last 2 weeks, but there were these islands of clarity when suddenly there was pretty normal functioning. And even when she was seemingly off and it was difficult for her to recognize anything, then there were subtle signs of something else going on in her. I also lost my father due to dementia, so already him I accompanied. And so what the awareness does in the deeper layers, we cannot say anymore from the outside, but it seems there is more going on than what we suspect. You seem to be very worried. You have a member of your family in that? Yes. I'm sorry, it's the end of the retreat, but of course we could have shared a little bit more about that. Because I've just been through a second time in my life, you know, with my mother-in-law, and before it was my father. So yes. And of course, not every dementia is the same as another one. All the way back there. The resonance and the subtle attunements. Yes, good word. If there are more formal interpersonal practices that I would teach besides the Kama Mudra, the sexual union. Sometimes we take more time for the art of deep listening. Deep listening is a practice, and then inside dialogue coming from the deep listening. You know, maybe you have heard about these terms. And actually, the whole practice of the first paramitas, you know, generosity, wholesome conduct, patience, and joyful perseverance, this includes based in love and compassion, this includes all of our life. So you were asking about a formal practice, and besides the informal practice of all our life, what we sometimes do are exercises in, you can say, emotional challenge. So to sit with someone who is going to praise your qualities and to see your reactions to it and to try to relax with it. Then the person changes and talks and criticizes all your defects, and then you relax with that. And like this, so to actually to not only do nice dialogue about the Dharma, but to have an interpersonal dynamic where we are sparing partners for each other. Yeah, so this is also possible practice. But actually, not much of that. I think there's much more developed by modern group therapeutic approaches and so on. And I think we will find a very rich support for our practice if we take these modern approaches. The old schools, they have processes described in the Vinaya, how one talks about one's challenges, one's downfalls, one's problems, and how the others react to that. And so there is already in this old text, there is a description of very wholesome group dynamics and non-violent communication. So helpful talk, but it hasn't been developed so much. Huh? Okay. All the way back at the curtain. If one can practice that with ADHD, I think you should practice it. You must practice it. But what else will you practice if not Mahamudra? No need to adapt it. You need, you know, the let's drop this description of the syndrome, but actually we are dealing with a very active mind. So a very active mind will have it difficult to enter shamatha, right? And to enter a calm mind. This will be like, you know, like talking about the impossible. So we need to work with the active mind. And the active mind will need a maximum of insight. So instead of starting with calm abiding and calming the mind, we start with maximum of insight to look into the storm, to look into the restlessness, to always see the nature of all of these many, many, many things appearing in mind. And that creates the space. And then with the spaciousness and the reduced clinging, then gradually, gradually, this also calms down. But you go a completely different way. And that's maybe the adaptation you were thinking about. The Mahamudra is the same, but the Shamatha Vipassana is different. You start by Vipassana, and you go from there to Shamatha. Yeah, the Mahamudra is still the same. So my observation is, and I don't like this the names, the diagnosis put on it, because it solidifies. Actually, these people are now in this phase of their life. They are active and they are called hyperactive and yeah, whatever. But actually, it doesn't mean that their mind cannot calm down. It just needs a different approach. And it can become a little bit more calm. But their constitution is probably such that for the rest of their life, always they will have a little bit more active mind than the guy next sitting next to you who can sit in very calm samadhis. This is not it. You will have very active samadhis, very creative samadhis, but undistracted creativity. You can develop that. So no one is locked into such a diagnosis. I had a retreat colleague who is a teaching lama now. He's 10 years older than me, so we have spent our time in my second retreat, time in 3-year retreat. We spent wall to wall. He was sitting behind the small wall behind me, and you know, we were back to back. And he was the active type. He would have gotten such a diagnosis, yeah, but in that time it wasn't given so often, but he would definitely have gotten that diagnosis. And I was the calm type. And we have gone our path together. He is still alive. I'm still alive. We are friends. And he is beautifully teaching meditation and practice and Dharma and no problem. And he is not the only one. One of my best friends with whom I've been teaching a lot got the diagnosis like that. And he studied sports and he was very active and he had to channel always his energy. But actually, yeah, finding a way and often also love and compassion, an incredible way to give a good direction to the activity of mind. And there are ways, I want to say. And there's a way out where you will know that you don't need that diagnosis anymore, but you are still an active constitution. That will probably not change. There is a different way. And maybe 10-20% of the people meditating, maybe rather 20-30%, they need to go this path through insight into the calm abiding. And it's getting more and more. Okay. Let me go first. a big Buddha statue. Mm-hmm. He always answered. Could I sing you? It's a definite experience. It's a cleared experience. Now it's two experiences, that the Buddha statue inspires you to talk with it, and that you hear an answer is a very common stimulation of your own Buddha nature, and that you have a connection there, the devotion, the trust. And yes, we get answers like that. And it's definitely not the statue answering. Yes. But there have been, you know, like there are things, like I was sitting once in a church, and the church was talking to me. It's crazy. No one was there, but I heard clear sentences. It's incredible things that can happen. Yes. So actually, good to know all of this is our own mind. Even the church is our own mind, and the Buddha statue also. Yes, but it's the better part of us. And that someone is caressing you, I'm only happy for that. So, well, I have learned not to differentiate between inside and outside. So I'm not so preoccupied when I also feel that. I know that feeling as if someone were caressing my skin, exactly like you also at the arm. Or, yes, and hugging. And yes, this is wonderful, and it's our own mind. Yes, yes, yes. And you know, this doesn't mean when we say it's our own mind that it can't be someone. You get me? No. Even when your partner is caressing you, it's your own mind. Yes, but it's not your own mind doing it. Something is happening there. And actually, we don't always need to interpret those phenomena. We don't need to know it's happening. It's okay. There's no dukkha. There is no suffering. It's happening. Something is happening, and we just don't need to make a difference inside, outside. Yes. Yes, and maybe you were being held. Maybe you were being held. Probably you felt like this, so you were being held. You want to know how to get that hug again? That's the problem. It happens. It happens. And you can trust, there's lots of phenomena. Let's not always try to find the explanation for that. Lots of phenomena. I also sometimes don't know where something comes from. I've had a few experiences here during the retreat where I don't know where it comes from. Yes? Okay. Happens. Okay. We need to go to dinner. You have been raising long ago, and yes, I take you. Last one. Yeah, bad karma, huh? Okay. The undercurrents, yes. either welcoming all the different experiences or being relaxed, then something happens. A fear that there could, that a fear to vanish. Oh, yes. Okay. So you observe that when you relax like this and you're very welcoming, very open, you observe that at some point this kind of fear arises. Yes, there is this point when you can't relax more, you can't contain more. I repeat for everybody. And your question is probably what to do? How to do what to do? This is what I meant when I meant, when I talked shortly about becoming familiar with that area where the fear starts. And you are still here. Nothing has happened. You haven't lost your mind. You haven't died. So if you enter that area and you don't, and really you don't try to relax more, but you stay where the first anxiety appears, the first signs of the, and there you stay as if you were looking around and you make sure that there is no actual danger. Yes? Like this, then trust builds. Okay, this far I can go. And like this, with your relaxation, you go gradually. You don't try to go further. You go gradually, always where you notice the fear starts. And that's where you stay for a while. You stabilize yourself there to develop that trust. Okay, this much is also okay. Like this, you proceed gradually. When you try to relax more, then you have heavy fear reactions and they can disturb the process because you are trying to go too quickly. Yeah, you need to go more gradually. Yes. Yes. Yes, it's kind of the same blockage. So it's so nice that you noticed that it is the activity of these undercurrents, but you know for yourself, it could also be that there are some biographical incidents which have left wounds or some difficulties which might be touched by relaxing more. So then you go even slower. Yes? Satisfying answer or not? Yes, you would love it to, we would all love it to go a little bit faster, but the patience with which you spend in these areas of opening where you feel safe, the patience to explore those areas, those new areas where you feel safe, this pays back, really. You will be so much more sure of what's going on. Instead of going through quickly, you explore and it will help you to help others because you know very well what you have gone through. Sunam de yitam jazing panin top nen impenjanam pam jeneng kengana chimbalam jumpai si petsu lendro vandra vashu en champem pavunjita kempada kanto zampo de yang de shin Jintang o vaman lam dum pa jo.